First of all, I'd like to begin by thanking all of you and all of my gracious hosts on this trip. It's been very heartening to come here for the second time. This is only my second visit to Dallas. And both times it's been a very exciting trip, and I've met some very committed brothers, and on the whole, from the design, I've had a very good time in being with you, and it's always been very sad leaving on the occasion that I have had to leave to go back to Washington. So again, very grateful for all of you to come here and to be so welcoming for us when we do come. Earlier in the day, we had a very successful Yom HaQuds. Inshallah, in the future, we hope that more brothers and sisters will show up to that event. I think the consciousness every year is growing. I think as the humanitarian crisis in and around Palestine becomes more and more acute, it's incumbent upon us to give as much attention as we can and to give as much support, emotional, financial, and otherwise, to our brothers in Palestine. It could be that at some point in the near future, we may need their support. And so if they're free and we're not free, and we give our support to them now when they need it, inshallah, they'll, in a state of strength, they'll be able to help us when we need their help. Because this entire ummah is one brotherhood. And it doesn't matter where you're from. What does matter is that you confirm that Allah Ta'ala is your sustainer and that Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is his messenger. And those are the only common bonds of our brotherhood. And so, so we hope, inshallah, in the future, this momentum continues to build until we solve the crisis in the Holy Land. As we approach the end of another Ramadan, and in this Ramadan, there are perhaps only 6 or 7 days left. And we might ask ourselves, how effective has our fasting been during this Ramadan? Is there a way for us to gauge our performance? We've been fasting, we've restrained ourselves from food and drink during the daytime as well as intimate relations. But we go through that exercise every year. And at the end of that period of building this willpower and this connection and this taqwa with Allah, is there a way for us to measure our performance at the end of Ramadan? How effective was our fasting? How effective was our intention to respect Allah Ta'ala's power presence in our lives? How much did we learn to guard ourselves from the corrective justice of Allah's power? And so one way, perhaps, that we can gauge our performance is to look at Allah's ayat as they pertain to Ramadan and see if Allah Ta'ala Himself is helping us to understand if we can judge how well we did during Ramadan. Allah Ta'ala starts out the frame of reference for Ramadan by saying, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. O you who are securely committed to Allah, fasting has been made an obligation for you, as it was made an obligation for the people who preceded you, so that during that month, you might begin to build up your taqwa. And so we can see that what starts out as an activity of الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ. And then two ayat later, Allah Ta'ala says, شَهْرُ رَمَضَانَ الَّذِي أُنزِلَ فِيهِ الْقُرْآنِ هُدًى لِلنَّاسِ. And so what starts out as an activity which is restricted to الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا ends up as هُدًى لِلنَّاسِ, as guidance for humanity. And so one way to measure our performance during Ramadan as Muslims is that when we fast, is this having an impact on improving the situation of the world that we live in? Because Allah Ta'ala says, شَهْرُ رَمَضَانَ الَّذِي أُنزِلَ فِيهِ الْقُرْآنِ هُدًى لِلنَّاسِ. You start out Ramadan as an activity of الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. And then by the end of Ramadan, it's supposed to project a level of guidance to all of humanity. And so we might ask ourselves and compare ourselves to the first generation of Muslims. As far as the Prophet ﷺ was concerned, he only fasted 10 Ramadan. And the companions around him only fasted 10 Ramadan. And we look at ourselves, and in the case of some of us, we may be into our 60th Ramadan. But the early Muslims, they only fasted 10 Ramadans, and by the time they finished fasting 10 Ramadans, the entire world picture was changed in a way that a new social order was introduced to the world. A social order which was communicated all across the known world at that time. And everybody in that world knew that there is a new way of behavior which is emerging out of the peninsula. And so the early Muslims, they used the time during Ramadan to liberate themselves of those things, food and drink, that bound them to the life of the world. And during the rest of the 11 months of the year, they used the energy and the taqwa that they had built in Ramadan to liberate the rest of humanity from those things which were tying them to injustice. They built up their willpower in Ramadan, and then outside of Ramadan, they helped the people who were in bondage to build up their willpower so that they could free themselves from oppressive power structures. And so when we talk about building up taqwa in Ramadan, we are really trying to avoid Allah's corrective power. Because this is what taqwa is. You're trying to avoid what could happen to you if you make a misstep and you're not conscious of making that misstep, and that Allah's corrective power comes to correct you. But when His corrective justice corrects you, it might be very painful. And so you have to learn to respect Allah's power during Ramadan. And the early Muslims did that. And when they did that, they noticed certain disparities in the world that they live in. And one of the biggest disparities that they noticed in the world that they live in, as they were themselves restricting themselves from food and water, is that an imbalance of food in society, meaning that there are a lot of poor people who don't have anything to eat. And there are very few wealthy people who have a lot to eat. And so they noticed that there is this disparity. And they made a connection between the disparity in wealth and the disparity in the distribution of food in society. And this is a key issue that I think that we need to understand. Because Allah Ta'ala ends this series of ayat about Ramadan by saying, وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَتُدْلُوا بِهَا إِلَى الْحُكَّامِ لِتَأْكُلُوا فَرِيقًا مِّنْ أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ بِالْإِثْمِ وَأَنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. Literally, the translation is, and don't eat your common wealth. وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ. with a view to trying to do something immoral or illegal with it. And then present that commonwealth to people in positions of rule such that the combination of concentrated power and illegally acquired wealth becomes a mechanism to consume popular wealth. Now what's going on with illegal taxation? Isn't this presenting your wealth to people in positions of rule so that when you present your wealth to them, that they turn around and figure out more ways to take more of your wealth? What about lobbying activities? You know, this ought to occur to us. That you have powerful special interests in a democratic society which are presenting money and wealth to people in positions of power such that they can secure markets and resources on the other end. And so we ought to understand that during Ramadan, especially during Ramadan, that when you see a disparity of the distribution of food on earth, that ought to be consistent with a misdistribution of wealth on earth. And so let's anchor that with a few examples. And I don't know if I can roll off all these statistics from the top of my head. I'm going to try. Let's take a look at some statistics related to poverty in the world. But before we get to that, let's take a look at the second ayah with regard to Ramadan. Allah Ta'ala says, أَيَّامٌ مَعْدُودَاتٌ فَمَنْ كَانَ مِنْكُمْ مَرِيضًا أَوْ عَلَىٰ سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرٍ. And this is the critical portion. وَعَلَى الَّذِينَ يُطِيقُونَهُ فِدْيَةٌ طَعَامٌ مِسْكِينٌ. That for those of you who find it impossible to finish a fast to the end of the day, for whom it's very taxing, you know, they just can't make it to the end of the day, restricting themselves from food and water. It's so physically taxing that they just can't make it to the end of the day. So as far as those kinds of people are concerned, they are required to feed some poor people. وَعَلَى الَّذِينَ يُطِيقُونَهُ فِدْيَةٌ طَعَامُ مِسْكِينٌ. Okay, so now let's ask ourselves that in the world that we live in, is there a class of people in the world for whom it is impossible to finish a fast from dawn to sunset and who are at the same time blessed with huge bank accounts? Because Allah Ta'ala is identifying a class of people in this ayah. He is telling you that in your society, there are people for whom it is impossible it could be medical reasons, it could be a whole bunch of other reasons, that they can't finish a fast to the end of the day. But at the same time, there's so much money in their bank accounts that they don't have enough bank accounts to fill them with. So is there such a class of people on earth? And I don't think you have to look very far. You can look to the princes in Arabia, you can look to all of the ruling classes in the Muslim world. These people, you know that they don't fast. But at the same time, you know that their bank accounts are full, not only in the countries that they live in, but their bank accounts fill the banks over here as well. So we ought to understand that when you see a disparity of food in society, meaning that you have a whole bunch of people who can't eat, congruent with that is a polarization of wealth in that same society. And so let's take a look now at some poverty statistics in the world. 3 billion people on earth, that's half the earth's population, make less than $2.50 a day. Of the earth's people, that's something like 5 billion people on earth out of the 6, they make less than $10 a day. That means that they earn less than about $3,700 a year. And keep your own expenses in mind as we go through some of these figures. Percent of the earth's resources are consumed by 25% of the people. The bottom 20% of the people consume 1.5% of the earth's resources. So you have 1 billion people on the top that consume 3/4 of the Earth's resources, and you have 1 billion people on the bottom that only have 1.5%. Now these ayat about Ramadan are talking about the experience of depriving yourself from food. But that ought to make you recognize that in the world that you live in, if you see poor people in the world that you live in who are barely scratching to get one meal a day, know that in that same society there is such a polarization of wealth that the people at the top of the pyramid have so much that they can probably feed all of those poor people 10 times over. It's just that we don't know who those people are, because there are various ways to help them stay invisible in society. Children. 2.2 billion children on Earth. 1 billion of them are in poverty. 9 million children every year die from being poor. 1.8 million children die from diarrhea. Diarrhea. All of us have experienced it. It's just a question of dehydration. But 1.8 million children every year die because of diarrhea. Water. Let's talk about water. 85% of the world's fresh water is consumed by 12% of the people. An average American consumes 160 gallons of water a day. An average poor person, just 5 gallons a day. In a week, an American consumes more water than is allotted to a poor person for the entire year. For the entire year. And most of those people who don't have access to fresh water, 2 out of 3 of them earn less than $2 a day. And the poorest of the poor people, their women, consume probably 4 or 5 hours a day going to get water and bringing that back home. Now think of the kind of economic advantages your society could have if half the population in that society, meaning the women, didn't have to waste so much time going and getting water. How much productive the poor societies could be. Not to mention that if clean water was available for bathing and for drinking, how much better the health of those people would be. And you could translate that into economic productivity. Electricity. 2/3 of the world's people have less than 6 to 10 hours of electricity a day. Global domestic product. The global domestic product, that's for the entire world, was $48.2 trillion. The wealthiest countries of the world, which comprise about 1 billion people, they accounted for 36.6 trillion. That's 76.6% of the global domestic product comes from 1 billion people in the world. 500 people, the billionaires on Earth, their personal worth is $3.5 trillion. So only 500 people. That's 1/1,000,000th of 1%. But they comprise 7% of the world's gross domestic product. For every dollar which is given in aid to a poor country, they have to pay $25 in loan repayments. You're thinking about your credit cards at 24%? That's a big hue and cry over here, right? Why do we have to pay 24% interest on exceeding our limits on the credit cards? Think about 2,500% for a person who can't afford to put dinner on the table, doesn't have electricity, doesn't have clean water, and he has to pay 2,500% in loan repayments for every dollar of aid which is given by the IMF and the World Bank. And the people who have to pay that $25 on every dollar that they get are the people who never contracted that loan and who never got that money. The distance between rich and poor.
This is a measure of how strong economies are. In 1820, the distance between rich and poor was 3-1. By 2010, the distance between the rich and the poor will be something like 100-1. Meaning for every gallon of water consumed by a poor person, a rich person on the other end of the spectrum is consuming 100 gallons of water. Or for every dollar the poor person earns, the rich person earns $100. Let's talk in the end about global priorities. In the wealthy part of the world, these are their priorities. Now, I'll list some of them. In Europe, or the United States, I'm not sure which one, $10 billion a year are spent on buying cosmetics. In Europe, $12 billion a year on buying ice cream. In Europe and the United States combined, $16 billion on perfumes. $25 billion in pet food. $100 billion in buying cigarettes. $210 billion in buying alcoholic drinks. $600 billion in buying illegal drugs. $2.5 trillion in war making. This is the wealthy part of the world. All of those together account for $3.5 trillion. Keep that figure in mind. Now let's think of basic social services for the entire population of the world, rich and poor alike. To give every child in the world a primary education, $10 billion. That's less than the cost of perfume in the wealthy part of the world. $10 billion. To give everyone clean water and sanitation, $14 billion. To provide maternal health for women, $18 billion. To give everybody health and nutrition, $20 billion. Now all of those four categories of social services add up to just $62 billion. Now what's $62 billion compared to $3.5 trillion, which is spent on pleasing yourself? And we're supposed to be understanding this during Ramadan. We're restricting ourselves from food and water. This just adds up to $62 billion to provide all these social services to every person on earth, which is just 2% of that other figure. So what that means that in the United States and Europe, if they spend 2% less on cigarettes and pet food and perfume and on drugs and on war making, you'd have enough money to provide social services to every human being on earth. Well, let's put it in a more direct way. When your brother farms a rubber plantation in Indonesia, or your brother is in a mine, a copper mine in Pakistan, or in a diamond mine in South Africa, or if he's farming cotton in Egypt, or if he's drilling for oil in Libya, he's doing so not so that he can have a clean glass of water at the end of the day. He's doing so so that your neighbor can go to the corner 7-Eleven and buy a pack of Marlboros. Or so that his dog can have enough to eat at the end of the day. That's why you are working. That's why your brothers overseas are working. And this is what we ought to be understanding during Ramadan. Let's talk briefly about the ability of the poor countries in the world to handle a disaster. We just saw what happened in Pakistan. All the masjids, perhaps across the country, they're collecting money for their brothers in Pakistan. We remember not too long ago the situation in Haiti, another poor country which was devastated by a natural disaster. But Allah Ta'ala says, وَظَهَرَ الْفَسَادُ فِي الْبَرِّ وَالْبَحْرِ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ أَيْدِي النَّاسِ. Corruption reveals itself on land and on sea, on land and in the sea. Why? Because of what the hands of men have brought upon it. Which is suggesting that there's no such thing as a purely natural disaster. There's no such thing as a purely natural disaster. Everything has to be, we're supposed to be recognizing the extent of Allah's corrective justice in our lives during Ramadan. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. So this ought to suggest to us that when you have a disparity of power on earth, people on earth who claim to be superpowers, people on earth who claim to be maximalist powers, people on earth who claim to be hyperpowers, or they claim to be the first global superpower on earth. Then when you have such claimants to power, we ought to be understanding, when you have that kind of disparity of power on earth, that there is the possibility that people who don't have power are going to suffer under these kinds of disasters. And why does that happen? Because the people who have the power have the wealth. And when they have the wealth, that means that the people who need the wealth don't have access to it. They don't have access, that means they don't have access to education, they don't have access to clean water, they don't have access to building a set of programs that could challenge a natural disaster before it hits. They don't have the capacity, they don't have the luxury to be able to develop their human capacity to be able to handle natural disasters before they strike them. Why? Because there is a disparity of wealth on earth. That's the reason. That's why Haiti couldn't handle the disaster, and that's why Pakistan can't handle the disaster. Because there is a disparity of power, and there is a disparity of wealth on earth. And if we were to be able to fix this thing and to correct this thing, everybody on earth would not be affected by the disasters in the way that they are being affected. And the last thing that I have to say in this regard, and unfortunately we Muslims often tend to parrot what we hear from people who go to academic institutions in the West. We often say, when we see something like this happening, that, you know, a disaster in Pakistan, or the disaster in Haiti, or the tsunami, or, you know, all of these are fresh in our minds. We say that this is a punishment from Allah because the people that it afflicted, they might have deserved it. We hear this very often. You know, we deserve the kind of government that we have, and because, you know, we don't have the mental wherewithal to change that situation, we might deserve some of these things that are happening to us. And I have to say, brothers and sisters, that I don't think that there's any hadith or any ayah which heaps this kind of intellectual degradation on people who are already suffering humiliation. The idea that something lacking in the character of poor people, people who are only trying to make a living, people who are only trying to put bread on the table, people who don't bother anyone, people who don't build nuclear weapons to drop them on other people, people who don't build corporations so that they can take advantage of their workers' rights in order to make profits, people who don't manufacture chemical weapons in order to test them on civilians, people who don't play around with the financial markets. The suggestion that something lacking in the character of these people merits for them characterless, illegitimate, irresponsible leaders is an insult to the human intelligence. And it's an affront to human dignity. The only people who deserve that kind of government and those kinds of leaders are the people who have the luxury of time and money and while away their time in drugs, in entertainment, in unprotected sex out of the bounds of marriage, in gambling, in political spin. Those are the kinds of people who deserve that kind of leadership. It's not the poor people of the world. The dua of the poor people of the world goes immediately to Allah. It has no intercessors. And this is what we ought to be recognizing during these months in Ramadan. And if we are to measure our progress during Ramadan, we ought to be asking ourselves that when we finished our fast at the end of Ramadan, that did that reduce the level of poverty in the world? Did that increase the number of people in the world who have access to clean water? Did that increase the number of people in the world who have access to electricity? Did that reduce the difference or the distance between the people who have wealth and the people who don't? Did that increase the gross domestic product of the poor people in the world? And if you want to measure how effective your Ramadan was, take a look at the world that you live in and ask yourselves these questions. That when we Muslims, perhaps 700 or 800 million of us, when we are fasting in Ramadan, did that have an impact on improving the world situation that we live in? And if your answer is no, then we have some hard questions to ask ourselves about completing our fast in Ramadan. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم فاستغفروه يغفر لكم فاسترشدوه يرشدكم.